Chapter 11.
No, the Ruhar flight instructor said with a plastered-on smile and a forcibly pleasant and patient tone that came across as irritated, impatient, and patronizing, as if she were speaking to a young child who could not understand how to perform a simple task.
You first have to
switch to the independent mode. Yes, I know that, and that is why I have the mode selected, Irene replied through gritted teeth, using her right pinky finger to indicate the independent operation symbol in bold letters at the top of the touchscreen display. With two human pilots learning to fly the starship from the auxiliary control center, the displays were converted to English words and symbols familiar to humans, like having positive indicators in green and negatives in red.
You don't have to be nasty about it,
the flight instructor huffed, her translated words coming across as distinctly frosty.
I wasn't being nasty.
Irene tensed in her pilot's couch, but kept her eyes focused on the displays instead of turning to confront their alien instructor. It slightly irritated Irene that they were being instructed by a young Ruhar whose rank of Klasta was roughly equivalent to a second lieutenant, while Irene and Derek were captains with many thousands of hours of real flight experience. Klasta Splun was freshly graduated from the academy, having taken the low-status assignment aboard the Toaster, only to build up flight hours in her logbook. The alien had little real-world flight experience. She was clearly bored and angry about being assigned to teach humans, and Irene wasn't taking any crap from her.
I do not like your tone, human,
Splun ground her incisors as she spoke.
I do not like being spoken to like a child by an instructor who can't read her own display,
Irene shot back, knowing that although the Ruhar probably could not or would not read the English symbols on the two pilot displays, the Klasta had standard Ruhar common language symbols on the displays at the instructor station. The Klasta tensed, lifting a finger to halt the simulation.
Perhaps it would be best if...
Derek turned in his couch to face their instructor, jabbing an accusing finger at her in a gesture he knew she understood.
Perhaps it would be best if you do the job you have been assigned. If you are not capable of that, we can request a more qualified instructor right now.
He held up a Z-phone.
Good idea,
Irene began to agree.
And you, he turned to his fellow pilot, do your job and leave out the comments. We've both had asshole instructors before, and you aren't making things any better.
He leaned toward Irene and pressed a button to transfer control to his station.
My spacecraft, he declared as he assumed the role of pilot in command.
Initiating approach, he stated as he authorized thrusters for manual operation.
Are you good, Klasta Splun?
Yes, came the curt reply. Sorry.
Irene's voice was soft.
Then louder. Monitoring remote guidance. Guide beam acquired and active.
Acquisition confirmed. The Ruhar behind them confirmed in a voice that held only a hint of anger.
Proceed at 1/4 power. Watch your heading, she added in a reproachful tone.
Heading dialed in, Derek reported with a smile and a wink toward Irene. He had the ship exactly on the designated heading, not only within the green band of acceptable error, but near the blue center line of optimal course. Derek Bonsu had learned the best way to respond to someone trying to bait you was to never take the bait. Ignore the insults, plaster a fake smile on your face, and pretend you did not understand an insult was intended. That often turned the tables and made his opponents lose their temper, while he just had a good laugh inwardly. Irene lifted a hand off the controls just long enough to give her fellow pilot a thumbs up, then returned her laser focus on the co-pilot's task of providing navigation data to Derek. She knew the heading they had the ship on was nearly perfect, and the instructor had nothing to complain about. Had nothing to do, because so far neither of the two humans had made any kind of significant mistake.
Course within 97% of nominal, Irene could not help reporting.
Oh, 98%.
The humans ignoring her, defying her, made the Klasta pissed off enough that she decided to deviate from the approved training course. With a tight smile at the trouble she was causing, she changed parameters of the simulation.
Star Carrier reports Hardpoint 3 has a mechanical failure. Change course to Hardpoint 7.
Without losing her cool or making a snarky remark, though she knew the hamster was screwing with them,
Irene smoothly pulled the navigation control to the new guide beam and fed the data to Derek.
Hotpoint 7 acknowledged.
Watch your...
That frigate will be crossing our heading, Irene warned as the instructor threw another complication at them. This one a ship that was coming into Hardpoint 6 and interfering with the toaster, although the larger and heavier training cruiser had the right of way.
Adjusting course to keep clear.
Taking power to 30%. Derek glanced toward Irene, and she nodded. Slowing down to give that frigate a clear path to Platform 6, he said, just as the simulated frigate suffered an unlikely engineering failure and veered toward the toaster. This time, Derek could not keep the smile off his face. He had anticipated the instructor throwing a highly unlikely problem into the sim, and he was almost disappointed at how obvious and unimaginative the complication was.
Taking power to 50%. Sound collision alarm.
50% is not authorized under proximity maneuver conditions, the Clasta snapped gleefully, anticipating an opportunity to reprimand the primitive aliens.
Reduce. The frigate has suffered an engineering fault of unknown severity and origin, Irene interrupted.
Emergency flight regulations require us to get a safe distance as soon as possible in case the frigate's jump capacitors or reactor explode.
With a grin, Derek reveled in the chance to truly fly the bulky cruiser, even if it was only in a sim.
Bring in main power online, thrusters at 80%.
The toaster's main normal space engines would soon be responding to his commands, surging the ship forward with awesome power.
Main power ready, Irene reported.
Releasing.
Pausing simulation, the Clasta said unhappily.
Resetting.
That was... She cleared her throat.
Acceptable. Our instruction course has not yet covered emergency flight regulations.
Again, Derek turned in his couch to face the Ruhar, wiping the grin off his face.
We studied those regs on our own before we came aboard the ship. We did not wish to waste your very valuable time, he added with a quick smile that he kept as genuine as he could.
Hmph,
Clasta Splun sniffed. For the next hour, she stuck to the standard training course, only throwing curveballs at them occasionally and only introducing approved complications. Chit-chat was kept to a minimum, and Irene was on her best behavior, knowing their success was the best way to piss off their alien instructor. After the toaster latched onto the Star Carrier, the Deal Me In had performed a series of jumps, then dropped off the training cruiser and other ships in dark interstellar space while the Giraptha went to pick up the other half of the battle group. Training had been suspended for 6 hours, as the toaster and the battle-damaged warships waited for the Giraptha Star Carrier to reappear and take them aboard. After 12 hours, with no sign of the Star Carrier, and with the warships busy patching up their stricken hulls and making repairs as best they could, the toaster resumed training on a limited schedule. Priority for pilot training in the simulators had been given to Ruhar cadets, as they would only be aboard the ship for another couple weeks before returning to the academy. So at first, Irene and Derek had been studying dull flight manuals by themselves, until Perkins asked why the ship's auxiliary control center could not be used to run simulations. With the cruiser hanging motionless in space, the AUX flight station was admittedly empty and unused, and all Perkins had to do was find an instructor who was willing to lower his or herself to training the most primitive semi-intelligent species in the known galaxy. Fortunately, instruction time partly counted toward qualified flight hours, so it was not impossible to persuade an instructor to take on 2 additional students. Unfortunately, since the best instructors were already busy, Irene and Derek had been stuck with the sour-faced Clasta Splun, who was predisposed to being grumpy because she knew no one else wanted to be trained by her. The Clasta was frustrated that the 2 humans had not quickly failed, which would have given her ample opportunity to insult them, and even better, would have allowed her to push at least 1 of them aside and use the simulator to build her own qualifying flight hours. More than 2 hours into the training session, she set a simple instruction to run and left the AUX control center to get a snack from the galley.
That's a relief, Irene began to say before Derek raised a hand and silently pointed to the flight recorder module between the 2 pilot stations. Whatever they said or did would certainly be scrutinized later by the Ruhar.
Real challenge, she recovered.
My turn?
Derek pressed a button on his console and lifted hands away from the touchscreens.
Your spacecraft.
The two pilots ran the simulation on their own, flying the starship through normal space to various points, until it almost became dull. Truly, flying even a light cruiser in normal space was not all that much different from flying a dropship. Flying in combat would be much more challenging, but they were far from enjoying that type of simulation. Several times Irene had to look to Derek, a huge grin on her face.
Think about it. We are the first humans ever to fly a starship.
Simulated, Derek reminded her, though that did not much tarnish their shared joy.
It's simulated now, Irene agreed, knowing the standard training course would include actually moving the big cruisers some months in the future. We were the first humans to ever fly a dropship for real.
Ah, except for Captain Desai, when that guy Bishop stole it to do whatever they did. She was the first to fly a dodo that we know of.
Fine, except for her, Irene admitted, wondering how the mysterious Desai had managed to fly a Ruhar dodo without any training.
Had Desai somehow gotten access to a simulator before she broke out of jail? No. It was more likely one of the whispered rumors was true, that the whole operation had been planned and run by the Ruhar, using Bishop's group of humans as a cover story. Unless the Ruhar clandestine operations people admitted the truth, no one would ever know. Irene looked at the clock on her console, feeling her back growing stiff from sitting so long in the pilot couch.
Is our instructor ever coming back?
The current sim program only had 10 more minutes remaining.
The sim will end and repeat soon, Derek pointed to the loop indicator that was showing active.
We could. Alarms blared and the simulation on their displays froze, then the consoles switched to show real-time images.
Hey, the Giraptha are back, Derek announced excitedly, recognizing the outline of the Deal Me In even though the displays and controls in front of them were now all in Ruhar common language script.
Damn, I am glad to see those beetles again.
He shot a guilty glance at the flight recorder module and decided to pretend he hadn't said anything noteworthy. They were aboard a Ruhar ship, and he knew the hamsters had their own nicknames for their Giraptha patrons. Hands off, Irene lifted her fingers away from the controls, which should not respond to her anyway, as she did not have the proper access code or biometrics. Even if she did, the auxiliary control center needed to be authorized to have any effect on ship systems, and that authority could only be granted by the senior officers. When the ship was maneuvering, the aux controls were supposed to be manned anyway, and Irene nervously looked toward the hatch for their instructor to return.
Maybe we should get out of these seats.
Oop, she added as artificial gravity began to fade. Cutting off gravity meant the ship could potentially be forming hard turns and accelerations. The display flashed to alert condition two.
Where is the cluster?
Regs say we remain in these seats until we are officially relieved, Derek pointed out, his tone reflecting his uncertainty.
We are supposed to put our helmets on. He reached under his couch for the hard-shell helmet. And button up.
Derek, we are not pilots, Irene sighed and reached for her own helmet.
Not yet.
She waved a hand at the consoles that were all showing the odd-looking Ruhar script.
I can barely read this stuff.
Me neither, but when Splund comes back, she will see we followed regulations to the letter and have nothing to bitch.
He remembered the flight recorder was still active. To reprimand us about.
Okay,
Irene agreed as her seat was the best place to watch the unfolding drama.
Wow,
she gulped as the ship suddenly slewed to one side, leaving butterflies in her stomach.
Those ships are really moving.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm reading this right.
Derek squinted at a blinking notice from the toaster's bridge.
But I think the Beatles ordered all ships to perform combat latching again. They must really be in a hurry to jump us out of here.
Derek.
Irene figured out the controls for the sensors and zoomed the image in on the Deal Me In.
Look at those ships attached to the Star Carrier.
Derek leaned over to watch her display before she mirrored the images on his console.
Woo,
he whistled as he took in the view of battered and in some cases crippled warships. There were only four Ruhar ships attached to the Star Carrier. But seven ships had jumped into action. Three ships were missing.
They were in one hell of a fight.
Oh, damn, look at that.
The Star Carrier took hits also.
He noted scorch marks and jagged holes in forward and aft hulls. Amidships,
The spine had cables flopping around, and pieces of the scaffolding bent or missing.
This is big effing trouble.
Damn, who has the balls to hit the Giraptha?
Before Irene could respond, Derek's answer appeared in the form of a Bosphorok battlecruiser jumping in close.
Oh, shit.
Clasta Splun flailed her arms in a futile attempt to steer toward a handhold, missing as she flew by in the zero gravity. When the Giraptha star carrier jumped in unexpectedly and the alarm sounded, she had been finishing a snack and chatting with a cute senior cadet. She wasn't that much older than the cadet, she told herself. Why, she had graduated from the academy less than a year ago. Splun had been struck with guilty panic when the alarm sounded, knowing she was several minutes away from her human students, and without artificial gravity functioning, the trip back to the AUX Control Center would take longer. The AUX Control Center was not her action station when the ship was underway, but she knew the senior officers would rightfully fault her for leaving a pair of aliens alone in a vital part of the ship. When the gravity cut off, she had been racing headlong down a passageway and clumsily stumbled, sending herself awkwardly soaring through the air out of control. The passageway where she needed to turn left had gone past without her being able to catch a handhold, and her plight only got worse when she crashed into a trio of frightened cadets. The four of them struggled to separate, and the cadets got out of her way, helping her turn in the correct direction. No sooner had she launched herself across a side passage when the ship lurched, making her bounce off a bulkhead and bending a wrist painfully. The ship was already maneuvering, and no one was available to provide backup to the bridge helmsman. Splun finally hooked a foot painfully on a doorframe and halted her tumbling flight. With determination, she pulled herself along the correct passageway, seeing with dismay the two adult crewmen coming in from a side route. They were assigned to the AUX Control Center. And now she had no chance to get the aliens out of the seats before anyone saw they had been left alone. Wordlessly, she gave them a quick wave between handholds, trying to make clear they were all going to the same place. She slowed to avoid a collision, just as a Condition 1 alert sounded. The three of them stared at each other for a heart-stopping moment. Enemy ships had jumped in, or their own ship was about to jump into combat. No longer waiting for Splun, the two crewmen expertly pushed off hard with their legs, zipping down the passageway toward where the open hatch to the AUX Control Center could be partially seen. They almost made it. Splun saw no point to the three of them trying to jam through the hatch at the same time, so she gave her aching wrist a break and eased up slightly. She never saw the railgun dart that was moving at an appreciable percentage of light speed. The first dart of the pair slammed into the toaster's shields that were already weakened by hits from enemy masers, forcing the shields to absorb and dissipate gigajoules of energy. The second dart, hitting less than 2 meters from its companion, was also mostly deflected by the straining shields. Mostly. 8% of the dart managed to penetrate all the way through to the cruiser's hull, having been turned into plasma that burned its way through the ship's light armor like it was tissue paper. After punching through the armor with little trouble, the hellish globs of plasma burst in a cone-shaped fountain of death, burning and destroying everything in a 16-degree arc, and only stopping when they encountered the inner surface of the armor plating on the other side of the hull. Three of the objects burned by the plasma jet were Splun and the two crewmen. Irene was startled not so much by the violent shaking of the ship as by the hatch behind them crashing closed. The quick automatic action of the hatch was not fast enough to prevent air being sucked out into the passageway, and Irene's flight suit inflated to compensate, with air hissing from a reserve tank in the helmet even before the visor could swing down. The flight suits they wore were based on combat skin suits, but were even less capable than flight suits used by crews aboard dropships and combat aircraft. When issued their new flight suits aboard the toaster, Irene and Derek had assumed the Ruhar fleet's thinking must be that if a ship were hit in deep space, a tougher flight suit was not going to be of much help. And Clasta Splun had not been wearing a flight suit at all, instead being dressed in the simple coveralls that were the standard crew uniform. Unless that hamster had been able to pause long enough to don an environment suit, she might already be dead.
Derek, incoming!
He watched transfixed in shock as missiles streaked in toward the toaster, with the forward section of the ship being pounded by repeated maser fire.
Unknown to Derek, impact of the second railgun dart amidships had pushed the cruiser just far enough to avoid another pair of darts that bracketed the forward hull, with one barely striking the shields a glancing blow. As the two human pilots watched helplessly, their cruiser's point defense masers exploded one missile at a safe distance, then another, but damage from the railgun hit amidships had knocked out defense cannons and sensors in that section of the ship, leaving a gap in defense coverage. Recognizing their vulnerability, the command crew fired thrusters to roll the ship, exposing the undamaged defense cannons on the other side. Unfortunately, the enemy also adjusted to circumstances, and the incoming missiles arced around to aim at the damaged area. The missiles were faster and more nimble than the bulky old cruiser, so they had the advantage. Still, the defense masers kept pouring megajoules of energy at the missiles, and sheer numbers were on the side of the defense. 11 maser cannons against only 2 missiles. Technology was on the side of the missiles. The ship was Ruhar, while the missiles were manufactured by the advanced Bosphorok. With invisible maser bolts streaking past, the smart weapons rapidly changed course and speed, ejected decoys, and projected false images to fool Ruhar sensors. Derek's stomach tied in knots while he sat rigidly in the couch, wishing he could do something. Anything. Yes! He pumped a fist as one missile stumbled into a hail of maser beams and exploded. In its death, the missile had one last move to play, and it detonated its warhead in a shape charge directed forward at the cruiser. High-density warhead pellets traveling a quarter of light speed blasted the cruiser's energy shield, heating the degraded shield generators near the point of failure and lighting up that vulnerable area of shield like a beacon for the missile coming behind. As the last high-tech missile jinked sideways at 3,000 Gs toward the weakened shield, a nearby Ruhar destroyer exploded, its jump drive coils having been punctured by a pair of railgun darts from the enemy battlecruiser. To Derek's terror, the blast of high-energy photons and particles washing over the battlespace blanked out the toaster's proximity sensors, and the cruiser lost track of the last missile for a crucial second. The missile, for all its advanced technology, also lost track of its quarry. But that was of little importance, for the missile knew the target's last position, and the big cruiser could not move far in a short time. Dropping all evasive maneuvers, the missile fired its engine for emergency thrust on a course that took it straight into the heart of where it knew the Ruhar ship had to be. Derek had no time to give voice to his terror, no time to shout a warning in case Irene had not seen the same data on her console. The Rue Tostella was tossed aside like a child's toy, spinning around so hard Derek's head hit the back of his helmet as the couch's restraint system automatically held the helmet steady to prevent him from snapping his neck. His brain rattled inside the shell of his skull. He struggled to make sense of simply who and where he was, the flickering displays in front of him forgotten.
Derek, you okay?
Derek coughed. Shook up, he admitted. In combat, he could not indulge in any macho bullshit. The other pilot needed to know he was not 100% right then. You?
Seeing double?
Irene blinked slowly to clear her vision so she could understand what she thought she saw on the ship's status display.
The front of the ship. Gone?
Derek instinctively wanted to shake his head. He also knew that more jarring was the last thing his brain needed right then. The ship was moving enough on its own, making the couch shake regularly with intermittent hard bumps. The shaking was probably caused by the ship's thrusters attempting to control the wild spinning of the ship, which was flipping on all three axes. Derek assumed the bumps were secondary explosions, a notion confirmed by new lights flaring on the ship's status display. Components were overloading and exploding all over the forward half of the hull. That is, the forward half of what was left. For a quarter of the ship's original hull was missing entirely.
Yeah, it's gone. Everything forward of frame 35 is just missing.
The sensors were showing an extensive debris field around and mostly in front of the cruiser, wreckage blasted away from the ship by an advanced technology warhead.
We're dead in the water.
He weakly lifted a hand to point to the status display, which showed half the defensive maser cannons were offline, and only half of those were even in a restart cycle. Shields were weak, and one shield, toward what was now the nose of the ship, was disconnected from a power source.
Why haven't the bird brains finished us?
Because we're just a training cruiser, Irene guessed. Tapping the tactical display, she added, They have more important targets.
Outside the ship, it was hell, with maser bolts, particle beams, and kinetic ordnance flying around thick and fast. The Bosphorak battlecruiser had already destroyed or disabled most of the Ruhar warships. The main fight now was between the Jarraptha and Bosphorak. The Beetles had their star carrier responding with every weapon they had, missiles ripple-firing from launch tubes and masers burning continuously. But the superior strength of the enemy's heavier ship gave them an overwhelming advantage. Damaged Ruhar ships were ejecting from their hardpoints, adding their own weapons to the fight, knowing they had little chance for survival. Survival was not their goal, and escape was impossible, as the enemy had the battle space blanketed in a strong damping field. Two Ruhar destroyers were flying directly at the enemy ship on a collision course, hoping to ram the battlecruiser. Their suicide tactic was intended to provide a gap in the damping field, allowing the vital star carrier to get away. Alert to the danger, the Bosphorak were slamming the destroyers with concentrated railgun fire. One, then the other destroyer, was struck several times until their shields were entirely knocked out, exposing them to the comparatively weak maser bolts that seared deep into the noses of the destroyers, making the forward armor bubble and melt, opening holes for the maser energy to wreck the unprotected interiors of the ships. The first destroyer veered away, corrected back on course, then veered in the other direction, its engines offline, drifting uselessly away into deep space. The crew of the second destroyer, knowing it would be crippled and out of the fight before it could ram the enemy, activated a self-destruct mechanism to drop reactor containment. A half-second later, as the white-hot fusion plasma burst outward and contacted the fully charged banks of jump-drive capacitors, warheads of all missiles still in the ship's magazines detonated to add their energy to the maelstrom. The destroyer was replaced by a small, short-lived sun that expanded outward in a sphere, so only part of the wavefront washed over the enemy battlecruiser. And at such distance, the Bosphorak warship shrugged off the assault with only a minor fluctuation in damping field strength. With all Ruhar ships inside the damping field either destroyed or disabled, including the unimportant training cruiser near the edge of the field, the Bosphorak turned the full fury of their weapons on the hapless star carrier that was making a futile attempt to run away. Jarraptha star carriers had reinforced shielding and armor protecting the critical engineering components of the aft hull. Knowing that bit of tactical intel, the Bosphorak aimed masers, particle beams, railguns, and missiles just forward of the aft hull where it attached to the long spine of the ship. The only break in their focus on the star carrier was to direct two missiles at the training cruiser, to kill it, before its mostly aimless course took it beyond the reach of the damping field.
"We should jump," Derek advised.
As he spoke, more missiles launched from the enemy ship, two of them curving toward the toaster and accelerating hard. The inbound missiles were highlighted by blinking red symbols and red streaks projecting their courses. A pair of missiles were projected to impact the training cruiser, and point defenses were mostly showing as offline.
"Jump! We can't do anything. We're just running a sim."
"Oh, yeah."
Derek tapped his console where an alert was flashing that the simulation had been abruptly ended, and the auxiliary control center now had full authorization to maneuver the ship. "Command authority automatically transferred to the auxiliary station when we lost the bridge," he declared, remembering that tidbit of info from the welcome aboard package they received when they'd been assigned to the cruiser. Derek never imagined he would need to remember such an obscure piece of trivia.
"We're the pilots now. Everyone aboard is counting on us."
Irene turned to look at the hatch, hoping trained Ruhar crew would come in to relieve them. That, she saw with a shock, was not going to happen. The hatch had scorch marks on the inner surface, and the upper left corner appeared bent, bowed inward. Whatever had happened in the passageway outside, it must have been bad. Very bad.
"Okay. All right.
Yeah, sure."
Irene's mouth babbled as her mind caught up with the situation.
"We've never performed a jump, or been trained in jump procedure.
We've both read the jump manual a dozen times or more."
Derek's voice was more squeaky than the soothing tone he tried to project.
"We can do this. If we can't,"
he swallowed hard,
Well, the ship is dead anyway.
Right. Okay. Good.
Irene took deep breaths to psych herself up to do the impossible.
We're caught in the edge of a damping field, Irene noted, even as her fingers called up the jump drive controls. She had only ever seen those controls on her laptop, not even in a simulator, and never for real.
Local damping field strength is a...
Reading Ruhar script was not her best skill.
32%?
She struggled to recall something she had read only once.
What's the safety limit for a successful jump?
28%, Derek stated. Or was it 29? Or 38? Other than casually scanning a high-level briefing document about jump operations, he had no experience with the system.
We can't risk a jump.
The red thingies are getting closer to the green thingy.
Derek jabbed a finger at the display in front of him where red symbols for incoming missiles were homing in on the toaster.
We need to jump now.
If we jump inside a damping field, the drive could tear itself apart.
If we don't jump, those missiles will tear us apart. That star carrier is about to blow any second. It's getting hammered. We need to do it now.
What the hell, Irene told herself. Decision made. Can you find where the pre-programmed jump options list is? We can't program a jump by ourselves.
Even if a jump was programmed in the drive navigation system, would it be usable without adjusting for the damping effect? She did not know, and that was the problem. Derek peered at his console, touching unfamiliar controls.
I think this is it.
I think.
Yes, system shows 100% capacity, he noted.
That had to be the jump drive capacitors. The toaster had not jumped in days, so the capacitors would be fully charged. The ship rocked from multiple maser beam strikes, yellow lights on the display showing where the white-hot beams had burned through the defensive shields protecting the critical aft engineering section.
Select the second option and authorize it, she ordered,
as she tried to find the controls to release power from the capacitors into the jump coils. One thing she did know for certain was that the coils could not safely hold a charge for long. Once power began flowing from the capacitors, the coils needed to be used, or the power discharged quickly.
Why the second option?
Those Bosphorak knew where the star carrier was jumping to. We don't want to make our jump obvious by using the primary assembly zone option. Ready?
She didn't need a reply, as she could see the second option on the list was now blinking blue.
5, 4, 3.
She reached out with her right hand to touch Derek, the jump now being on automatic. Derek took her hand, squeezed it, and turned to say something, when the ship violently skewed and shuddered as the Jarapa star carrier exploded. Then they jumped.